So some of you know Dharma holder Bob Waldinger from last night's or this morning's Doksan. And some of you know him because he's the guiding teacher for the Henry David Thoreau Sangha in Newton, affectionately known as Hank. And he is a Dharma holder in Boundless Way Zen and also an ordained priest. And we're happy to have Bob here for a few days and this morning to share with us his wisdom and his Dharma talk.
At ease and in harmony, from Zazen Yojinki, Things to Consider in Zazen, by Keizan Jokin. Sometimes when you are sitting, you may feel hot or cold, discomfort or ease, stiff or loose, heavy or light, and sometimes startled. The mind may feel as if it were sinking or floating. It may seem dull or sharp. Sometimes you can see outside the room or inside the body or the forms of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Sometimes you may believe that in this moment you have attained wisdom and now thoroughly understand all the sutras and commentaries. These extraordinary conditions sometimes arise. Just keep body and mind at ease and deportment in harmony. Shed worldly sentiments and do not become attached to sublime feelings about the way. Though you should not spare the Dharma, do not speak of it unless you are asked. If someone asks from the heart, then give the teachings. If you wish to speak 10 times, keep quiet 9. It's as if moss grew over your mouth, or like a fan in winter. A wind bell hanging in the air, indifferent to the direction of the wind, this is how people of the way are. Do not use the way to make yourself important. This is the foremost point to remember. Remain always in great compassion and dedicate the limitless power of Zazen to all beings. Maintain the vow to realize awakening and just sit. Do nothing at all. This is the way to study Zen. Keizan, the second great founder of the Soto School of Zen. We heard from the first great founder yesterday in Steve's talk, from Eihei Dogen. Keizan lived 800 years ago. And he was an extraordinary man. He founded many monasteries. He gave the precepts to lay people as had never been done before. Scores of lay people, farmers, people like us, not sparing the Dharma assets for just those who wanted to live in monasteries. He tried to bring the Dharma to everyone he could. And one extraordinary accomplishment is that he was the first master to give Soto transmission to a woman, to a nun. He was very supportive of women and did not want them excluded from studying the way. So when I wanted to find out more about Keizan, I Googled him and I made a couple of extraordinary discoveries. First, Kazan Jokin has a Facebook page. And you'll be pleased to know he has a Twitter account. Now, it won't surprise you that, as far as I could tell, he hasn't tweeted anything in 800 years. But the Facebook page really has a little portrait of him and his date of birth, and it has posts from him. He hasn't posted any pictures of himself at wild parties. He hasn't. He's not relaxing at resorts anywhere. But he's there. He's there on the web. And in some ways, it seemed fitting to me, because as I read this selection, he could have written this last week. And he could have written this for me. So one interesting thing to notice is the difference between Kazan's voice and Dogen's voice. Dogen. Steve bravely took us into the world of Dogen yesterday. Beautifully. Difficult. Often best studied in groups so that we can support each other as we break our heads over his prose. Kazan was actually called grandmotherly in his time. And the sexist reference is a little unfortunate, but the meaning was that there was a kindness in his Zen, in his teaching style. And that kindness comes through in this selection. Things you may want to consider in Zazen. And it's a good reminder to me that each of us has our own voice. Each of us has our own Dharma. We come forward completely uniquely in this way. And we contribute completely uniquely in the world of form. Nothing to be but ourselves, as David told us last night. I'm often fond of the Oscar Wilde quote. He said, "Be yourself. Everyone else is already taken." So Kazan has a grandmotherly voice. And he's reminding us of things that happen to me all the time in my practice. He's saying, you may have these experiences in Zazen. Sinking, floating, discomfort, ease. And you may have visions. Bodhisattvas. Seeing places you've never seen before. And sometimes you may believe that in this moment you've really attained it. You've really gotten wisdom. So many times I've been a sesshin and I thought, oh, that's it. Now I got it. Now I know how to practice. And this is what I'm going to do from now on. End of story. That usually lasts less than a half an hour. Kazan is taking us to that place we often go, the mind of has and has not, the mind of I've got it, or I haven't got it, and I want it. He's pointing to those experiences that we hear about, those openings, great and small, that Kensho, great enlightenment, or tiny, tiny turning of awareness. And he's reminding us that when we have those experiences, not a problem, but nothing to get attached to. And often, we imagine that there are certain experiences we are supposed to have on the cushion. And if only we work hard enough, we'll have this kind of experience or that kind of experience. And Keizan is reminding us not to get attached to experiences we've had and not to worry about experiences we haven't had. He's reminding us that anything we can think about this way is not it. Anything we imagine we're supposed to get or achieve isn't it. That our Soto ancestors remind us that it is the embodiment, it is the living out of the Dharma that we are doing here. It is the Dharma doing the Dharma. It is Zazen doing Zazen. It is bringing ourselves into alignment with the Buddha nature that arises everywhere in every moment. He notes that we shouldn't spare the Dharma, but don't speak of it unless you're asked. I'm remembering how excited I was when I discovered this path, and how I wanted to tell my friends, and I would start chattering on and on about it, and people's eyes would glaze over. There's a story of a young woman who got very excited about the Dharma, and she would go home and try to tell her family all about it, and they would hate it. And then she realized, and she wrote, "My parents hate it when I'm a Buddhist, but they love it when I'm a Buddha." That Keizan is inviting us to embody this practice. Without thought to how we're doing, without thought to what experiences we're having, without the need to convince anybody else, let alone ourselves, that we have some special way. Do not use the way to make yourself important. This is the foremost point to remember. And people often try to make us important when they learn that we practice this way. Oh, it must be so amazing to go on retreat. It must be so wonderful. So, if we can't rely on any special experiences that we're supposed to have or not have, if we can't rely on a feeling that now we've got it, now we know how to practice, now we have wisdom, if we can't rely on some special feeling, now I'm a practitioner of this incredible way, what can we rely on? What are we doing here? And now we circle back to Dogen's teaching that we heard about yesterday, and that Keizan points us to. The great gift of this practice, of these hours and hours on the cushion, is intimate observation. When everything changes, when the bottom falls out of our practice, when we're lost in hell realms, when we're lost in joy, what we can come back to is intimate observation. This turning toward again and again and again. Always there for us. In each moment. And he says, it will leave us like a wind bell hanging in the air, indifferent to the direction of the wind. So not caring if we're in pain or we're sad or we're lonely. Not caring if we're in a hell realm. Well, that's no human being I've ever met. I'm never going to be a wind bell completely indifferent to the direction of the wind. But this gift of intimate observation gives us the capacity to stay with the wind, however it blows, to stay with it longer, with greater equanimity, to keep turning toward and not having to turn away. And that gets to the second point that Keizan makes, which is that he says, remain always in great compassion and dedicate the limitless power of Zazen to all beings. How do we remain in great compassion? What I find is that it brings me back again to intimate observation. Because as I watch what comes up in my own heart, compassion arises. No need to manufacture it. It's just there. About a year ago, one of my closest friends was diagnosed with a terrible illness of which he is dying. And I came to Sesshin right after I received that terrible news that I was going to slowly, slowly lose one of the most important people in my life. So I sat here on the cushion. And at that time, there were lots of atrocities happening in the Middle East. And I was feeling so alienated from everything. And I sat here in this Zendo, feeling sad and helpless about my friend. And suddenly what arose for me was rage and images of wanting to throw things and slash and burn. And of course the feeling that this can't be it. This isn't me. This isn't what's in my heart. And then I remember going into Dokusan and saying to the teacher, I don't understand why everybody isn't a terrorist. That what I found was a depth of anger and helplessness and alienation that suddenly, in a moment, put me in compassionate contact with those people who I felt so unlike. And the more I do this intimate observation, the more I find everything in my heart that's out there in the world. And there's a lot out there in the world that I loathe right now. But all those impulses, angry and sexual and envious, all right here in this heart. And that allows me to be compassionate, not because I'm trying to be, but because it just arises. At the same time that I will work as hard as I can to stop the playing out of those impulses in the world. how vital it is for me to do that. Compassion is there in ways I never expected it to be. Compassion for the people who want to build walls. Compassion for the people who want to exclude others for ridiculous reasons. Because all of that lives in here. This is the fruit of intimate observation. And this allows me, at my better moments, to remain in great compassion. So this is what we have. This is what we can embody. Nothing to get, nothing to hold on to. Just coming back to this process of looking again and again, a process that takes physical stamina, emotional stamina, so much grit. So when Kazan says, do nothing at all, who knew that doing nothing could yield such rewards? And who knew that doing nothing could be the hardest thing in the world? Thank you.
So please make yourselves comfortable and we'll have our Dharma dialogue.
So we do nothing if we see this, the dark cloud inside of us, and yet we need to act compassionately in the world and resist, and our deeds are what we get benefit from, so we must act while seeing that inside, as we were saying.
Yeah. And one of the things I've come to understand is that we act in part to help people keep from harming others when they can't help them.
And I think it's so important to say this over and over, because this language can sound like, oh, do nothing.
Yeah.
And we're not saying do nothing. Mm-hmm. We're saying do nothing. And sometimes that requires great activity and engagement in the world, and to give our life to protect life and to serve life. So, thank cannot be said enough. Thank you for bringing that in. Yeah.
Susan.
One of the things that occurred to me as you were telling your story and talking about what does it mean to do nothing, I think probably one of the elements that gives rise to this rage and stubborn dedication to something that many of us think is wrong is all these things have happened and nobody cares. Here's where I am and nobody cares. And I think sometimes if we can just care, that can make a difference. It sounds like Pollyanna, but if you can make some gesture of recognition that somebody hurts and that you care, I think that can do something to touch a person.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It doesn't sound like Pollyanna at all. Mm. in it. You said you're talking about terrorists, I'm assuming, like the people with the rage, and what was the other thing you said about them?
Terrorists, but even just people that want to build a wall and,
right.
and want to take health care away from somebody else. And I mean, it's hard to imagine somebody really standing face to face with another person and saying, I don't want you to have access to medical care.
Yet. But you said great rage, and what was the other thing you said? Do you remember? Anybody remember? Because I was very struck by, you could be talking about Zen students. right? Because the translation of great determination from the Chinese is a determination of great fury. Like there's a fire under us. We are on fire with, I've got to do something. Mm-hmm. And a great dedication, I think that might have been what you said, to just keep going. And so to see these people who seem oppositional, as you say, people who may not know that they're being paid attention to, and that caring that you bring to them, I think that's just what Bob was talking about in the talk. This is to me what compassion is. It's not like, oh, I'm going to be really nice to everybody, right? It's like things are really difficult. It's impossible to live a human life. And I have to do something. And so that's the determination of great fury. You know, I've got to. And then we sit. And the natural arising is the connection. And that's what you're talking about too, Susan. Your heart can... my heart goes out to folks, right, who are so stuck. Because I can be that way too. This is all human being stuff. And I just love the story of you being at Sashin with that rage. You know, that's what, that fire, it was just a slight shift, turns into a power for the way.
Yeah.
And that's what you were saying. Yeah.
You know, and Susan, I think just our Zazen is an expression of that caring, is an expression, this matters. Knowing these hearts and minds really matters, and it has consequences in the world to do this work. And so just our embodying this practice now here is a demonstration of caring that's real and has real consequences.
It also reminds me of, I believe it's John Gottman, someone who's done a lot of research into relationships, and he's looked at what are the most destructive behaviors, and ridicule and criticism. But one of the ones is stonewalling, when we put someone out of our heart, that he really sees that this is a kind of violence we can do, and we do it to each other. But I think you're talking about this on this larger scale. When we put other human beings out of our heart, other people feel that, and there's an impact to that that's so important to notice, and that we can choose something else, not to put people out of our heart, to acknowledge and honor everyone's existence.
Well, I was reading Be Here Now in the parlor the last few days, and I wrote down a quote out of it, something along the lines, your protest can only be effective to the extent that you can love the person whose ideas you are protesting as much as you love yourself.
Wow.
And I've been kind of sitting with that as a koan for a couple of days, like how could that be?
Yeah.
how could I love the people who have those ideas?
Yes.
And what I came up with is I can't, they're too remote. They're not people in me. I can love the people that are nearby that buy those ideas. But and that's
yeah.
enough.
Yeah. 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 Right, because the people nearby, and we can know them a bit, we can see them a bit. It's hard to see those people who are so far away. That quote reminded me of one that I use a lot now, which was, I don't know who it's from, but it was a minister who wrote in the 19th century, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle." And if we think about absolutely everybody, even the people we hear about in the news, these iconic demons, as fighting a great battle, filled with fear, and anger, that it can bring us closer to some ability to protest with love, oppose with love.
And short of that.
Yes, yes.
Because, it's a little bit hard.
Because let's get real here, right?
Yeah, let's get real. I mean, really. We talked about this a while back. You know, the person that I think of when you bring this up is Donald Trump. And what we've mentioned, and I think I've come to realize this, is that I've been practicing hatred and getting really, really good at it.
Mm.
And that's not so skillful for me.
Right,
you know,
right,
I find that it's
right.
much easier to drop into that place than it's been for years.
Mm.
It's like I took a course.
Yeah.
Right? Here's how to have the oppositional to idiots. And so I think the first step, of course, is to recognize the hatred or the oppositional quality in our own hearts first, and not try to do the spiritual bypass, the leaping over to no, I'm going to love Donald Trump.
Right.
He's person too. He must be so lonely in the middle of the night with his Twitter account. Just a poor guy. It feels fake, right? So there's a gap. And that's where the practice is. The arising of whatever is arising, like Kaizen talks about at the beginning of this. And then that gap, that pause, what is this? And then that, again, turns into the rage I was just talking about, the fury. And that fury burns itself off into compassion.
Right.
It's not that compassion replaces the fury. It's that fire of justice,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Justice. We were playing cards with Josh Roshi and his wife, David and I, and it was a card game where you had to name Trump, which has been really painful for me.
Yeah.
Just playing cards,
yeah,
no longer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Josh came up with, he said, let's stop calling it Trump, let's call it justice. So we started to say, spades is justice for this hand, and I'm justicing. It didn't work that well. but it kind of kept bringing up, it's like a version of attention. You know, like what you were saying at the beginning of our some period, Fran, that this attention is a loving thing. And suddenly if I can love my anger, that's transformative.
Right.
So forget about the guy with the Twitter account.
Yeah.
Kaizen or Donson.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for saying that. I think that's so important. And then that gives us, there is a choice point. And some, what am I practicing?
Mm.
I love, because we can practice derision and scorn, and I'm not like that. And the impact on that for us. And this possibility in our practice to practice compassion, not as an abstract concept, but right in the moment, as a kind of acceptance of what's here, so that we turn toward opening our heart to what is here, not to some abstract ideas. So if anger and burning and rage is here, right in this moment, we can practice, and what we practice, we becomes us. But it's so subtle, and thank you for...
Mm.
Yeah, it's quite
yeah.
subtle.
Yeah.
Really appreciating the talk and this discussion, and what's coming up for me is I've really been struggling with the, what feels like the continuous onslaught of my being enraged and my practicing of hatred. Of it, and it's just, it's like a volcano for me. You know, I see something on the news or I hear it and all of a sudden it's just, yeah, I mean, you know, just like uncontainable. This, and for me, often that visceral reaction and the rage comes first and then it turns into, I just hate it, you know, and I, when you said that about the fire sort of burning off, I forget exactly how you put it, but I kept, what was coming up for me was, yeah, if I could just get a little space to do that. Because I just feel like it's continuous trauma over and over, you know, and I'm like, sometimes just can't even get enough room to breathe. And I wondered if you could say a few words about how
Bob and I
work
really
with that.
To say
right?
Something.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, please.
So one of the
things. Please help me. So, I'm crying out in desperation.
So one of the teachings I loved is from Thich Nhat Hanh, who reminds us that what we put into our minds creates our minds, right? That shapes our minds. Right? So, you know, just like what we do here is we're not on our bunks reading romance novels, we're not reading thrillers, we're not checking our phones, right? We are, it's custody of the eyes, but also custody of the mind at Sishin, right? And there's a way in which if we, in the world, there can also be custody of the mind, and that doesn't mean burying our heads in the sand, but that means, for me, it's been knowing the difference between when someone wants to intrude and shape my mind and what I choose. And so I'm much more cautious now about that. Just like we take care of each other and don't demand that we look at each other and don't demand that we speak and all that here, I'm not going to let a particular news organization demand that I get all agitated by what they throw my way. Right? And so that for me has been, I'm trying to become my own curator and I use Sishin as a model.
And just similar, but a little bit different. The word trauma that you bring in, when working with trauma, many people, a history of trauma, you know, I think the whole country maybe has been traumatized by this past year, whichever side of the political divide we're on, because of this elevation of separation that's become so much a part of it. So part of the work with trauma that I learned when I was working with people with trauma is that you don't keep going into it. And if you can. Now, some people are in situations where there's no let up. They're in wars. They're being tortured. The just awful, awful things are happening all the time. So that's, you know, that's the most extreme version. We actually have some privilege, right? So it's important to be grateful for that. First world eye problems, or ego problems, my problem that we have. But in classic trauma work, there's something called pendulation, where here's the terrible thing, and you come right up against it as much as you can with the help of someone who can keep you safe. In our case, it's the practice, right? Mm-hmm. The intimate observation is the phrase you use. And it gets too much. And then you make this choice to rest in the breath, go out for a walk in the garden, look at the sky, anything you can do. And I remember nun who worked with still works with Thich Nhat Hanh, Sister Chan Kong, when I went on a retreat with them, was talking about this very thing. This was 30 years ago? Yeah, it was 31 years ago because it was just before I got pregnant with my daughter. And she had this newspaper practice where she wouldn't listen to the radio, she wouldn't watch television. It was too painful. She had lived through the Vietnam War. Right? She was a trauma survivor. so was Thich Nhat Hanh. And she would settle herself into her zazen posture, open the newspaper, and read a headline, and then just feel it. And if she felt like she could bear it, she'd read the article. If she couldn't bear it, she'd turn the page and read another headline. So it was the same kind of thing, this pendulum, going back and forth like a pendulum. How much can I take? And sometimes, you know, it used to be the wisdom with people who survived torture or war or anything, just get them to talk about it. It turns out that's not wise. It turns out that what we have to build is resources for the other swing of the pendulum. So, and everybody's different, right? Everybody's got a different set of needs around this. And part of our job when we're meeting people in Doksan is to see what needs to be built. Some people have stayed their whole life away from the fire, and we want to encourage you to get closer. And other people just have been burned up to pieces, and we want to build the resource of zazen, right? And everything in between. So I think for each one of us, it's very personal. And just the last little bit about that, we talked about this, the song of the jewel mirror samadhi, and the line, turning away and touching are both wrong, for it's like massive fire. That's one of the ways I understand that. If all we know how to do is turn away, we're limited. Right? We have to learn how to turn towards. And sometimes if all we know how to do is touch, then we just dissolve not in a positive ego-reducing Zen way, right? Our whole ego structure falls apart, and we might go crazy. So turning away and touching are both wrong, and it is like massive fire. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to be human.
Just one other quick piece of that. One of the things I try to remind myself, that it's a part of me that is feeling all this rage and outrage. And I can have compassion for that part. Mm-hmm. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Love that part that's hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
So I just wanted to put one more step in there that I go through, which is that rage that boils up on a daily, hourly, minutely basis, is always preceded by and accompanied by and followed after by enormous fear.
Enormous fear.
Fear. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just fall into this well of fear. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid we're going to turn into a Hitler state. I'm afraid for my child's future.
Yeah.
I'm afraid everyone's going to die of illness that's easily treatable. And the rage, it took me a while to figure out where the rage was coming from, but it's coming from fear, not from frustration or hatred or, you know, that stupid idiot, he's so selfish and self-centered and narcissistic and psychotic and every other label I can throw at him.
I'm talking.
The wisdom that sits at the front of the room. That's who I'm talking to.
Yeah.
And so I described myself when I came to Sesshin last week as a walking mound of ashes. Mm-hmm. I just felt hardly alive. And I can descend into panic attacks so easily. You know, and panic attacks are something I conquered long ago for myself. They're not ego panic attacks, like, oh my God. These are, the world's gonna blow up, you know?
This is
World War III. And we're just waiting for it to start.
Well, and I think you make this such a good point that we can sometimes put a label on it and say, oh, it's this. And what you're really pointing to is the possibility of keeping investigating.
Mm. Yes.
And what's underneath and what's underneath and this kind of, to me, that's a kind of compassionate attention. And our vow is whatever is here. So we, under the rage is this fear. And then we cultivate this possibility to be with the fear, exactly like Melissa was talking about. You know, so overwhelming it can take us down the toilet, right? So that's not helpful, but we touch it and we know it and then see what it is and what it might become. Not just fear, these other things too. So thank you so much for broadening that.
Yeah.
And Libby, when you're talking, I heard even more than fear. A great grief. Right? And grief is such an important emotion here as well. And it's not a negative emotion at all. I don't think any emotions are negative. I think they're just the arisings, right? So to do the same work, as David was just saying around the fear, we can all do with the deep sadness about where the planet is heading, where the political realm is heading, and a deep sadness of just about what it means to be human. I think even with, that's what's so great. Kaysan lived 800 years ago.
Yeah.
And he didn't know about global warming or where we were heading, but the grief that drove him and the fear, and the Buddha, in fact, talks a lot about fear, about being present with fear, being free in the midst of fear. You know, that can we have our fear? Can we have our great sadness? Can we have our anger, whatever is arising, without making that quick leap away, as you're saying?
Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to add that what Melissa was saying about that, whether it's anger or fear, that when it kind of burns away, subsides, we see more and more, then there can come moments of clarity. I find if I'm just in the midst of anger or fear, my clarity is not there. And that it's hard to get clarity, but we do have to act. We do have to put one foot in front of the other in the world. And that it is in this investigation and in the watching it burn away, and settle, that a kind of clarity can emerge. That then empowers us.
That's really important. So, even though there's so much more we could say, the real business is to do zazen. So let's come back to our sitting posture.